you there. So I'm Brian Stone. I'm a professor of city and regional planning at Georgia Tech in Atlanta. And my work is focused on climate change at the urban scale. And so urban heat island formation is a key piece of that. And I'm thrilled to be able to talk to the folks on this call today because you are the ones who really are on the ground able to put these policies in place. So I'm going to be talking about a few overview points here today. I'm going to talk about the difference between global scale and local scale climate change. Neelam gave a great overview of the urban heat island effect. And so I just want to briefly differentiate that from what happens at the global scale to avoid any confusion. Talk about trends in extreme heat around the country, and then why we should be concerned, particularly in state and local government, about extreme heat and how the heat island effect is driving that, so health and infrastructure impacts. And then what we see across cities in terms of their attempts to plan for heat management today. So this first graph is of the global temperature anomaly, and it's probably familiar to most of the folks on the call. And this is showing essentially evidence that the global greenhouse effect, of course, is occurring at the global scale. Temperature anomalies are just a deviation from a long-term average. So that zero line on the graph is the 1950s to 1980s average global temperature. And we see pretty rapid increase, particularly in the latter half of this period. And we know that's being driven principally by the accumulation of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Cities, of course, are subject to the global greenhouse effect, as the whole planet is, but they also have that superimposed on what's happening in terms of land use with the urban heat island. And so these are major drivers that Neelam talked about, so I won't spend a lot of time on this, but it's just important to note that these are driven by land use changes as opposed to being driven by changes in the composition of the atmosphere. So we've asked the question in my own research group at Georgia Tech about what are the differences between cities and the planet as a whole in terms of how rapidly they're warming. And what we see here is data from the 50 largest cities across the United States. And we're graphing temperature change within the cities themselves. That's the red temperature trend line. And then we're graphing temperatures in rural areas outside the cities. And this shows us a number of interesting trends. The first thing we note is the orange trend here matches very well the global temperature anomaly. So these rural areas are warming much as we see across the planet as a whole, and that's being driven by greenhouse gases. The red temperature line, of course, is warmer in all years, and that's because of the urban heat island effect. So the difference between the red and the orange lines here is evidence of the urban heat island effect. And then we have these arrows that tell an important story. If we look at the two arrows on the left side of the slide, we have the short arrow, which is showing essentially the contribution of the global greenhouse effect to warming within rural areas and cities in the mid-1970s. And then the longer arrow is showing the relative contribution of the urban heat island effect. And what we see in every year, even more recently where those arrows look to be about the same size, is that most of the warming that's happening in cities is actually a product of the urban heat island effect. The global greenhouse effect is a major driver, and it's becoming increasingly important. Urban heat islands are significant drivers of climate change in cities, and so that gives us a set of tools that we can use to manage heat. The other point illustrated by this graph is that urban areas are not only hotter than rural areas, they're warming up much more quickly. And so if we actually graph this, is what we see here, is we can compare the global rate of warming, and this is computed on a decadal basis, so the amount of warming per decade over this 50-year period. If we look at all the cities in our data set, the 50 cities, we see what we call an amplification rate of about 50%. And that means that cities, most large U.S. cities, are warming up at about 50% more rapidly than rural areas nearby and 50% more rapidly than the planet. What's important to note is that there are some cities, a small number, that really the heat island isn't growing much. These tend to be slow-growing cities. Some of these are in the Rust Belt areas of the country. If we look at just those cities where heat islands are growing, that's about 70% of all the cities, we see an amplification rate of about 100%. What that means is that these cities are heating up at double the rate of the planet as a whole, or double the rate of areas around them. And so that raises some significant issues for the timing of climate change is happening more rapidly in cities, and the intensity of the effect with respect to heat. So we expect, as average temperatures increase over time in cities, that we'll start to see more extreme heat events like heat waves. We've certainly seen a lot of evidence of that this summer. But if we look over a much longer period, which is more reliable, we look at, again, at 50 years, what we find is that all these heat wave characteristics tend to be moving in a direction that is problematic for cities. The number of heat waves per year, the duration of heat waves, the timing to the first heat wave every year, and heat wave intensity, all these things are moving in a direction that will create significant public health and infrastructure challenges for cities. And so I want to talk about that just briefly in a few slides. Heat wave mortality, the public health threats of heat waves, tends to be really underestimated. We've seen some recent events globally. Europe in 2003 had a prolonged heat wave in which it's now estimated that more than 70,000 people died in the course of a single summer. That's obviously a huge death toll. That's the deadliest weather-related disaster in a developed part of the world ever. The Russian heat wave 2010, over 20,000 people died. These other bars are just here to show you, you know, in terms of relative magnitude of the threat, and not all these things are weather-related, but the tsunami in Japan, 9/11, Katrina, these are events that received a lot of press coverage in the media. But the heat waves tend not to receive as much coverage, particularly after the heat subsides, and they're very deadly. In addition to that, the infrastructure impacts are substantial. And again, heat waves are kind of accelerating the time, or the heat island effect is accelerating the time to which we have to deal with this in cities. Softening tarmac at airports, we have buckling rail lines and roadways. We've seen plenty of this actually this summer in heat waves. And so this is, again, a tremendous challenge for cities that we have to deal with in the present period. Most critically is your electrical infrastructure. In 2003, the same year as the European heat wave, we had a massive blackout. Some of you on the call might have been in the blackout zone in the northeastern U.S. About 50 million people lost power. This only lasted for about 24 hours, but had it been prolonged, it's easy to see how the United States can start to approximate events that happen in Europe or Russia, places where they don't have widespread air conditioning like we do. This can become very dangerous, particularly if you're losing critical infrastructure, not just in terms of cooling, but water delivery. And these trends tend to be increasing over time. The number of blackouts across the United States per year is shown here, and this has more than tripled over the period that you see. So the likelihood of an extreme heat wave with a prolonged blackout in a major U.S. city is certainly increasing. Just my final couple slides here. Climate action plans are the principal mechanism that most cities and states address climate change in their planning. This is an example from Portland, Oregon, which is an excellent climate action plan. What this shows in the pie chart are the range of strategies in these plans, and they tend to all focus on reducing greenhouse gases, which is critically important and we need to do. But again, as I mentioned, in the last 50 years, most of what's driving warming in cities is the heat island effect. So we need to really be addressing both greenhouse gases and the heat island effect. So we looked at climate action plans for the largest cities across the U.S., to see how the strategies that are being adopted, whether they're focused on things that we're going to hear about later in this call, like albedo enhancement, which is just increased reflectivity, cool roofs and cool paving, vegetation strategies like green roofs, tree planting, and then efficiency strategies, which not only reduce greenhouse gases, but can reduce waste heat emissions in cities. So we scored the plans, and we found that actually very few cities and states are focused on these issues in their climate action plans. Of all the cities that actually had plans, they all had greenhouse gas mitigation strategies, but only about 25% had heat island mitigation strategies. And so if we're going to be dealing with extreme heat in the near term, that is our most effective set of strategies, and that's exactly what you'll be hearing about today. So just to conclude my major points, the pace of temperature change, the scale of cities is actually much more rapid than we're seeing as a planet. And that's not always widely understood. Every measurable characteristic of heat waves are moving in a problematic direction. Heat waves account for more weather-related deaths than all other forms of extreme weather combined in the United States. So it's a very serious health threat. And then most climate action plans are not incorporating the types of strategies that would be most effective to manage heat in the near term. And then just for your own information, this final slide, I'm of course plugging my book that Neela mentioned. I appreciate that, but this is actually written directly for folks in government and local and state government, as well as other practitioners. and it's designed to highlight the range of strategies that are going to be discussed today. And then a few more technical papers if you're interested in delving down deeper. So with that, I will conclude, and I look forward to questions at the end of the talk.
Great. Thank you, Brian. And so I think we've set the tone that he can be addressed to help us in the medium to long term in dealing with our infrastructure to help with a lot of the health issues as well as other environmental issues. And so as you think about, as you get warmed up for implementation, we do have, we'd like to know about some of your challenges as you start, challenges that you anticipate for cooling your heat island. Please select all that apply. And your responses to this will also help the presenters focus in on some of the challenges that you anticipate or that you're already experiencing. So if we can see the results for this particular question. And finding funding and resources is one of the highest rated answers. And I do think that it will be interesting to see to hear from our case study presenters how they actually partnered with different organizations and integrated cooling their communities into other initiatives. And I see the other two, as you all, understanding and explaining the benefits. Hopefully some of the information that we provided will help with that. But if you have additional ideas, please do submit them through questions or during the exit survey. And then lastly, again, designing and implementing programs. So what kind of policies you might pursue in your communities or what type of pilot programs or ordinances. These are exact things that our presenters are going to talk about. So.